Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. And it's been a while since we've had Trent Horn for 2 hours. So buckle up. Get ready. We've got Trent for 2 hours, which is always a great thing. Trent Horn, of course, the author of many books, including the very popular Why We're Catholic, Persuasive Pro-Life, and a whole bunch more. But now very well known as the proprietor of the Council of Trent, a podcast, YouTube channel endeavor that he does. You can find it all about it at TrentHornPodcast.com. Trent, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Cy. I enjoy being the proprietor of this fine establishment, aka podcast.
I don't know what to say. Like, I settled on saying proprietor because I don't know what creator of, maintainer of, producer. Like, what is a person that makes a podcast? What's the modifier for that person?
I think probably host.
Host. But you make it though. I mean, host seems too small. Like I'm the host of Catholic Answers Focus, but that doesn't mean I make it.
No, I have a team that does work with me behind the scenes on a lot of the elements, but I have helped them lift a lot of the load because I have a previous background in film and television production. I did film TV in high school. I worked for a television station in college. So I will record the episodes. I edit them somewhat, and then I send essentially a final cut to the Catholic Answers staff, and they add a few bells and whistles.
So they do a lot of stuff they don't tell you about, though. They fix so much stuff, and they don't tell you. They go, "Oh, great job, Trent."
Oh no, I know that they alone really are the reason I am telegenic at all.
Yeah, right. They do a lot of special effects.
People who have never met me in real life, I am actually a 5-foot-tall bald person. It's quite amazing all the effects that they add later on into post to give me this head of hair and all that. Proprietor, I always think, is just like the guy who runs a restaurant. I am the proprietor of this fine establishment here,
well,
good sir.
I struggle because it's such a weird medium in a certain way. It's not like TV where you're just the host. Like Anderson Cooper, he's the host of 360 or whatever. But he doesn't make it. He's not the...
You
podcasters are more than that. That's what I'm trying to say
more than just a pretty face on camera. I'm Trent Horn. Is it more than just reading off a prompter? No, a lot of people, and especially for people who want to get involved in Catholic apologetics and want to go... I mean, we have a real democratization of influence and spreading mediums now with the internet that we haven't really seen since the creation of the printing press 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's just dramatically changed
how
people can share information. Yeah. The problem there is similar. Catholics are late to the game on the printing press. That's why Protestants got an upper hand and all that. And Christians have been late to the game in the digital sphere. So we really need to catch up there. So I love seeing more Catholics out there. But honestly, you turn on a mic and a camera, you have to pick up a lot of other skills, lighting, video production, editing. It's a lot. And I'm still learning how to try to make things look good and figure it all out. But we need more of those voices out there. That's for sure.
The one thing you're missing, I don't mean this to be too harsh of a criticism, is you're not hateful. And I really think
I thought you were going to say an elaborate bookshelf behind me.
Every Catholic book, every single Catholic podcaster with the bookshelf behind them. I just feel like, there are people in the Catholic podcasting and YouTube world who have done it while being loving and charitable. And I'm thinking of Father Mike Schmitz, Matt Frad, you, but you know you could double your clicks tomorrow if you would just start hating some people.
Oh, get that so sweet, sweet dopamine hits of my followers.
Yeah.
Get people. It is surprising to me that cable news channels that stoke fear, anxiety, and anger, they seem to do...
They do really well.
Oh, so well. Yeah. Well, people get it. They get addicted to that stuff.
Yeah.
Like they see something and it makes them... It's funny. They see a video. They know it's going to make them mad. But they want to watch it anyways. They'll click on it if it has something that will make them mad, but they also know the person hosting the video agrees with them and will chime in and say, yeah, we should be mad. This is terrible. Like, you won't watch a video with somebody that makes you mad because they challenge your worldview. People are like, I don't want to see that. But if it's somebody who's mad on my team, We can be mad together. That would be, there's a, now I guess if I ever quit Council of Trent and just was in it for the money, I could start the Mad Together podcast.
If you're in it for the money, just write a book called Why We're Catholic Too, because that thing sold a lot of copies.
Why We're Catholic Part to Do.
This part time, to do. It's personal. Totally. I think it was Darren said I should call you Intergalactic Commander of, was that you, Darren? Yeah. So how about that? Instead of proprietor of the Council of Trent, Intergalactic Commander.
I'm just a regional Starfleet commander, but I'm willing to.
You're such a humble soul. Yeah. It's a drop calls open forum today. Do you know what that is?
Drop calls. They may have been missed, but they will never be forgotten.
I like it. Look at you, a natural, just coming up with the tagline. Carlo invented this in a burst of creativity. He said, "Why don't we do shows where we take the drop calls, and especially the ones we like, and answer them?"
It's better than the original idea I had, which was the dropped children hour. They may have been missed, yeah, but they will never be forgotten.
The dropped children, that thing, yeah, it just wasn't going to take off.
FEC, all kinds of stuff.
Legal department was like, nah, that seems like
it's just a headache. But yeah, when we do the show, it is hard on Catholic Answers Live. We'll have callers and people will be waiting patiently on the line. Like we'll have full phones, we'll have six lines and people are all in and they're waiting and you go and either, they don't want to, they check out early or the missed connection or something happens and we get the crux of their question, but we don't get the caller. And that's always sad because sometimes I see one like, oh, I really want to answer that one. And then they're gone. It's like dust in the wind. On air,
I know, but we've gathered them for you. So
we've
now
we've gathered it.
We've gathered the dust
from the four winds,
and we've breathed
together.
Upon it, and now it will come to life. Dave,
it's not that graceful. What we do is more like burying them in the Catholic Answers pet cemetery. The questions come back, right, but not the way we like them.
Yeah, probably comparing ourselves to the divine creator was a mistake. I apologize for that. Now we will move on.
Sometimes better let the question stay dead, Si. Yeah.
All right, here we go.
Better let it stay dead.
David in Houston, Texas, he doesn't know it, but he's starting us off today. This call was dropped, and we're sad that it was because David wants to know this. What is the Catholic Church's stance on the current conflict in the Holy Land?
Well, the Church as a whole doesn't have like a stance or a position on, evolving political issues, especially things that are happening in the news immediately. I mean, the Church will have positions on issues that come up in society. You'll have teachings that will come forward, like let's say in an encyclical, for example, deal or instructions from the CDF dealing with issues we've never dealt with before, like in vitro fertilization, new reproductive technologies, legal abortion, stuff like that. Even things related to new conflicts in war, for example, the Second Vatican Council spoke about the new effects of modern weaponry and how they should not be used indiscriminately on civilians. So we don't have a teaching on the Church on this, but we do have opinions and exhortations that have been given that should be received with, at least with respect, from Pope Francis, for example, reflecting a prudential judgment on his part of what ought to be done. And I think it's very sensible, something he said immediately after the October 7th attacks from Hamas, this terrorist organization against civilians in Israel, targeting women, children, brazen attacks. I think it was calculated that given the number of people that were killed versus the total population of Israel, it would be on par if September 11th in the United States had 13 times as many fatalities, that instead of 3,000 people being killed, 40,000 people were killed on 9/11. It's absolutely horrible atrocity that took place, and Israel has now responded with military operations in Gaza, seeking to defeat Hamas, the elected government there. Quote, put quotes around all of that, if they're even in Gaza, but to defeat Hamas essentially. So what Pope Francis said, it was recorded on October 11th, shortly after the attacks. He said, "It is the right of those who are attacked to defend themselves. But I'm very worried by the total siege in which Palestinians live in Gaza, where there have also been many innocent victims." Part of the thing also there is that Hamas will not allow people to leave Gaza, for example, to leave the violence that they've sowed with this attack. So I think the Pope is striking a good balance here in saying that Israel was attacked. We believe in just war theory as Catholics, going all the way back to Augustine, that if you are attacked and there is a clear and dangerous threat, you have the right to respond to that threat, but you must use proportionate means in doing so. The means that you use to respond cannot create greater evils. So, for example, it would be illicit for Israel to simply just drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza, indiscriminately killing civilians, and, of course, ratcheting up the capacity for a global thermonuclear war, a game where the only winning move is not to play, to quote from War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Ali Sheedy. Don't leave Ali Sheedy.
Of course, Ali Sheedy. Anywho, a great, great film, by the way, and a cautious and important one in the world we live in. So, yeah, they have the right to defend themselves. But I know some people have said, well, the civilians in Gaza, they voted for Hamas. They get what's coming to them. Well, think about it. We live in the United States. A lot of times, it's a majority that voted for somebody you don't like, or you vote for people and then they go off the deep end. You really would prefer they had not done that thing. They're still civilians. They're not soldiers. And so the difficulty here, of course, in this conflict is that Hamas uses civilians as human shields to protect their military sites. So they will put military fortifications under hospitals, under schools. And this requires deliberation, and people are going to have disagreements about what is appropriate. Because if you just have a policy that you can never harm civilians, I remember Judith Jarvis Thompson, she has a famous essay on abortion, but she wrote an essay on just war. And she said, well, if you can never harm civilians, what if the Nazis had just strapped civilians to all of their tanks? Would we have just let them take over Europe, for example? So it is difficult when evil people use civilians as human shields. You have to take care to not indiscriminately or disproportionately target civilians, but always with what you do, you should treat them as innocents and do your best to minimize those casualties as much as you can. And I think also what Pope Francis is doing in recent weeks as the conflict has unfolded has called for a ceasefire in the area. And I think that's a worthwhile and noble goal, provided that a ceasefire doesn't translate into simply Israel surrendering and Hamas being able to continue its acts of violence towards Israel. So it's war, war always represents failure. Pope St. John Paul II, you think he said war, never again war, writing in one of his encyclicals. It does represent a failure, on at least somebody involved has committed a moral failure. And that's why we as people of peace have to always pray for peace in our world.
Yeah, it's hard to remember that sometimes in the modern world, that the blessed are the peacemakers bit in Christianity. It didn't get it didn't get thrown out. It didn't get abrogated. We have an obligation to be peacemakers in the world. I don't know how much influence we have in the current conflict, but we got some. We can certainly pray. Trent,
absolutely.
Thank you. David, thank you for the question from Houston, Texas. We got to take a quick break. We will be right back with more. Drop Calls open forum with the Intergalactic Commander, Trent Horn, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
This is Father John Trigilio. We need Catholic Radio because it is a lifeline to Holy Mother Church. Catholic Radio enables us to know what the Church teaches, but also to have solidarity with one another. It is one way that we express our commonality, our communio, that we are family, and by staying together, we can be God's children here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. If you were sitting and thinking during the break, boy, I wish I could get 10 to 25% off at shop.catholic.com. In some cases, more than 25% off. You're in luck because the fall sale is still going on. Just go over to shop.catholic.com. Everything on sale, 10 to 25% off, and some of it even more than 25% off. Goodness me, what a sale. Shop.catholic.com. Did you think I sold that, Trent?
I thought I
did pretty good on that one.
Absolutely.
Giovanni was, at the time that he called, was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. The call dropped, but I am so glad that we saved this call because I really want to hear your answer to this question, Trent. I have read this story. The question is, have you heard of the egg theory story? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts are that it is, I guess, let me explain what it is, and then I will give my thoughts. So The Egg is a 2009 short story by Andy Weir, W-E-I-R, Weir. It's weird, almost. We're close there. So Andy Weir wrote this short story, The Egg. It's been published in a lot of different languages, republished. There have been many videos about it. It's basically a story about reincarnation. It's written in the second person. I have a soft spot in my heart, by the way, for stories like that, because there are very few stories. Normally you get first person, which is I did this, I did that, or third person, you're God overlooking the whole story, and it's just told, there's an omniscient narrator. They're not all omniscient, but there's a remote narrator telling you what is going on in the story. Second person, it's like you are taken into the story as a character. And so it starts like you died in a car crash. You know, it was nothing fancy, but it was fatal nonetheless. And you die and you go meet what's supposed to be like God or a God. And the idea behind the story is that you learn eventually that you have been reincarnated and will continually be reincarnated. And this world, this creation, is an egg for you to eventually grow and develop and become a divine being yourself. And every time you die, you are reincarnated as someone else. And the idea is that every single person in creation is actually you, just at a different point of the timeline, having been reincarnated. So you are every victim of the Holocaust, you are every Nazi guard, you're every follower of Jesus, you're every follower of Muhammad. Every time you were hateful towards someone, you hated yourself. Every time you loved someone, you loved yourself. And once you learn this great truth, you eventually hatch from the egg, so to speak, and become a god and can create your own thing, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. It's an interesting...
Did you just yada, yada, a yada, short yada. Story?
I didn't just yada, yada it. I yada, yada, blah, blah, blah it.
Oh, okay.
I gave it the ultimate. To think of it as a piece of fiction, I don't know. It's the character's not that interesting. It's me, second person, which, by the way, as I said, I have a soft spot for second person. The only other book that I know of written in second person is Bright Lights, Big City. It's like a weird 1980s themed drama. It was eventually adapted into a film with Michael J. Fox. Not very good. Aside from that, so it's like, it's not that interesting of a character. It's me, okay, whatever, and everyone else involved. The story, it's more interesting because of this idea, and people that get hooked on it are like, oh man, maybe that is the way things are. Okay, I mean, just because that's possible doesn't mean that it's probable in any sense. We have good reason to believe that no. Hebrews 9:27 says it is appointed for men to die once and then judgment, that we are not continually reincarnated. Also, if we're continually reincarnated, this applies just to general reincarnation as well, which assumes there are other people distinct from me, that if I'm reincarnated to learn a lesson, but I have amnesia every time I start a new life, how am I really learning anything? What's interesting is that the basic concept of reincarnation has been something that the church has combated since the very beginning. You had Irenaeus, Tertullian, other early church fathers and ecclesial writers making arguments against reincarnation, that we're just reincarnated into other people or animals. So Tertullian gave an interesting argument. He said, well, if reincarnation is true and you always end up as another person, then that would mean that the global population of human beings must be stable. It could never grow if everybody just turns into somebody else. And so he didn't have the data at the time to prove that it's not stable. We now know, look, it doubles like every 30 or 40 years. So you are not just a reincarnated person, you're a brand new person. So this takes a twist on the reincarnation angle, saying not only are you reincarnated, but you are reincarnated into different people, so that eventually, whenever you interact with people, it's always another version of you. To me, I would just say that you can tell this story, but it's not actually coherent. It's metaphysically impossible for all of these different individuals to be me. For all, you know, to try to say that I could exist in two separate places. I mean, maybe that would be possible in some kind of weird time travel thing with just me and I have one temporal line. But I don't see how it's feasible to say, okay, everyone I look around me now is me. I just haven't been reincarnated yet, but they are me. I just think it ultimately, it's incoherent. It's nothing to put your thought in. And plus, it's also the personal identity issues. If I am me and then some other person in India right now is also me, how are we the same person when we're doing two separate things and we are existing at the same time? Maybe we were both born at the same time. It's interesting, but I wouldn't take it too seriously. We have pretty good evidence that we are not reincarnated. Rather, the lessons that we learn in life are those given to us now through the growth of virtue and the reception of grace that God gives us through faith in Christ.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear your take on it.
What did you think of the story?
I thought, you know what, it's well structured in the sense that it gives you a little burst of insight about what it's about in the very last lines. And I always like a story like that leaves you with this, oh, that's what this was all about. So it's a well-structured little story, but it's utter nonsense. I mean, I have a basic policy that I go by. If in order to believe something, I have to also believe that I am Jesus, then it's not true because I'm not Jesus.
That would be the other thing, that you're Jesus Christ. You died on the cross and you were the Roman soldiers.
Right.
And I also think, though, the story has a very selfish lesson to it. It's like, it's wrong to hurt other people because they're also you.
Yeah, I know.
That's the only reason I shouldn't hurt other people. How about both of us have dignity and we are created by a perfectly good being who is infinite in goodness and knowledge and power and existence itself, and we are brothers and sisters, well, especially through baptism, we're brothers and sisters, same children of this God, but we're the same creation of this God who gave us each dignity and immortal souls. The idea that it's just, if you start to think about it, if I married someone and we fell in love with each other, it's just because different aspects of me fell in love with me.
Yeah.
That's like the ultimate kind of narcissism.
It is, right. And I do think one of the things you have to learn is that you can enjoy a story without thinking it's real, that it has any connection to reality. Like, I read science fiction stories all the time that have robots that are, for example, intelligent in the way that a human is intelligent. That's metaphysically impossible. That can't ever happen. But it doesn't mean I don't enjoy the story.
They did an AI thing recently. AI, African countries start with K.
Oh, I saw that. There are no. You go ahead, read it if you haven't. Yeah, it's funny.
ChatGPT. That's correct. While there are 54 recognized countries in Africa, none of them begin with the letter K. The closest is Kenya, which starts with a K sound, but is actually spelled with a K sound. It's always interesting to learn a new trivia facts like this.
I love how ChatGPT always adds that little, how fascinating this is, the thing that I'm saying. And it's saying utter nonsense.
So that's the difficulty there. Yeah, so you're right. When you listen to science fiction stories, you have to suspend disbelief on things. Or we showed our kids Freaky Friday with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan recently, and they liked it. They thought it was super funny. But which, of course, was actually an older – oh, that's a newer adaptation. The previous one, what was it? I think it was a Shelley Duvall or it was somebody.
Oh, no, the one with – what's the little girl? It's going to come to me, but go ahead. Yeah, the original.
Well, originally, it's a novel from 1972 written by Mary Rogers.
Was it Tatum O'Neill?
It was, let's see here. Jodie Foster.
Oh, Jodie Foster. Yeah.
Yeah, Barbara Harris and Jodie Foster do the original Switch. That was in 1976, actually. But the Freaky Friday, and it's an interesting story. It's like, what if the father became the son and the son became the father? I think the original one, even before Mary Rogers' novel, is like, it's like some like 19th century British story with a magical stone. I think it caused them to change their appearance, not to switch minds. But swapping minds is impossible. That can't happen, but it can still be a fun story to
think
about.
It's a great story. Yeah, right. Yeah. Time travel into the past is impossible, but they make great stories. All right, right back with more Drop Calls Open Forum with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Getting to enjoy some time with Trent Horn. You know Trent from his podcast, Council of Trent, which you can find at trenthornpodcast.com, or you can find it on YouTube where it has more than 100,000 subscribers now. Come on, are you kidding me? You can just hang out here and hang out with Trent while we do. We're giving him drop calls. These are calls that, you know, they come in, you see them on the call sheet, and then they disappear. The person drops for one reason or another. And that doesn't mean we have to get rid of the question, though, because sometimes we really like those questions. So we gather them up, and we give them to an apologist, and that's Trent's job today. Trent, this one comes from Andrew in northern Utah, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. We don't usually get like a very specific like region like that of a state. Usually I don't have any idea why they gave us northern Utah, but there it is. He says, I'm in RCIA. Maybe there's a big like thing between the north and south in Utah. Maybe they don't get along. Am I unaware of some kind of Utah civil strife that's going on?
I am not familiar with that. I mean, We have enough North, we got the North and South Dakota. We got North and South Carolina. We don't need another North-South state. It's been
No. We just don't need trouble out of Utah either. I mean, we count on you, Utah, just to keep things mellow. We don't need trouble out of you.
That's literally, it's keep it mellow. You're the Utah Jazz. Come on, enjoy the jazz.
No, settle down, Utah. I don't know what the problem is, why this person had to tell us he's from Northern Utah, but just all of you calm down. I'm in RCIA, Andrew says. I'm struggling with the Immaculate Conception. Where did this idea come from, and does it have roots in Scripture?
Well, the idea of the Immaculate Conception, so what this means is that the Blessed Virgin Mary, being the Mother of God, the creature that the Creator chose to be through whom to become man, to assume a human nature, this creature who has this important plan in salvation, part of divine revelation is that she is essentially the first disciple. So Mary was the first person to say yes to God, to receive Jesus. She was really the first Christian. She received Jesus. So being that first Christian, that prototypical Christian, if you will, the church has come to see that Mary received the first graces of what would be given to disciples, namely that she was given the benefits of baptism all the way to the beginning of her existence. So baptism removes original sin. Mary was protected from all sin, original sin from her conception, and then from any actual sin throughout the course of her life. That God gave her grace, the grace that Christ merited on the cross, was applied retroactively to Mary at the moment that she was conceived. So the Immaculate Conception is not the same as Christ's virgin birth. It's that all of the merits from Christ's death on the cross were applied in a fitting and retroactive way to Mary so that she was completely protected from sin in virtue of her being the Mother of God. And so this was, as I said, it's not necessary, but it was something fitting for God to do. And I think we have many clues that point to this reality. So for example, we have in Luke's gospel, Luke chapter 1, when Angel Gabriel announces to Mary, "Hail Mary, kakara temene," which is sometimes translated "favored one," but is more accurately translated "full of grace." And this is used especially as a title for her. We often say, "Hail Mary, full of grace, Lord is with thee in the Hail Mary." But in the text, the angel says, "Hail, full of grace." He uses it almost the title is like a name for Mary. And this underscores something very special about Mary being full of God's grace as a part of her identity. And so we see that, and this understanding, the church gradually over time came to have greater clarity on Mary's radical holiness. In the early church, you don't have as much discussion about Mary being preserved from the moment of her conception from original sin, because the concept of original sin itself was not explicated until the time of St. Augustine, when he was engaging the Pelagian heretics. And so Augustine and the other Orthodox Christians had to lay out a framework to show that because Adam sinned, Adam and Eve sinned, the gifts of grace that God had given them were not passed on to their children. And so that was not passed on to us. We have been deprived of that grace from the moment we came into existence at our conception. And that has to be given to us to make us children of God, and that's given through baptism. So the church fathers, you know, there's more development on this to understand. There was a general consensus about Mary's radical holiness, even her complete freedom from sin. Some people still disagreed about whether she was protected from sin from the moment she was conceived, or was it the moment right after she was conceived? So there's a little bit of theological hair splitting there, as happens with these dogmas. There's even on whether Christ is fully divine, you have questions, well, did Christ have a fully human soul? Did he have a fully human will? What does all of that mean? That wouldn't be settled for many centuries after the time of Christ in ecumenical councils. Eventually, this was settled in a papal encyclical in the 19th century. And that is where the church dogmatically defined in an infallible way that Mary was completely preserved from sin from the moment of her conception. In that ex cathedra papal teaching from the 19th century, I want to say 1854. So, so I would say that is just what I would give is just sort of an overview to the doctrine. I've talked about this also on my channel. So I would say that it has roots in scripture and tradition that point to it. We're not sola scriptura Protestants. We believe there are many teachings that are not found explicitly in scripture that the church, by its authority, can help guide us to understand and see. There's one other piece of evidence for Mary's Immaculate Conception I find very interesting. I've talked about it on my show before. So there's a philosopher, Jack Mulder Jr. I think he became Catholic, but he came up with this argument before he was Catholic, saying that Mary's Immaculate Conception. Now, some people make a mistake of the Immaculate Conception. They say, in order for Jesus to have been born sinless, Mary had to be sinless from her conception. The problem with that argument is it creates an infinite regress. So then if, in order for Mary to be sinless, Anne has to be sinless, and Anne's mother has to be sinless, and going all the way back to Eve, and that doesn't really work. But the Catechism does talk about a necessity for Mary being full of grace in order for her to say yes to God, for her fiat. So Jack Mohler Jr. has this argument that God essentially asked a teenager to become pregnant to bring his son into the world. All right. So if God is going to ask a woman to become pregnant, the woman saying yes, no part of that could be her saying yes out of fear of what God will do if she says no. Because if someone agrees to become pregnant because they're afraid of what the other party will do, that's bordering on rape. That's bad. Mm-hmm. And God is perfectly good. It can't possibly be any, God's involvement in asking Mary to do this can't possibly be anywhere near that boundary line because of his perfect goodness. So what would be the answer to it? Well, if Mary were full of God's grace, so much so that she always made the right decision, she never sinned, that she knew that any decision she made was always in accord with God's will, then when God asked her to bring his son into the world, she knows either saying yes or no will not displease God. So there is no part of her saying yes is motivated by a fear of punishment, which in the history of the covenants of salvation history, in many cases, God asks people to do things, and when they say no, there are negative consequences. Look what happened to Jonah, for example. So that does happen to people. When they say no to God, God says, okay, you're going to have to be a consequence for this. But here in this particular case, that would seem very unsavory for the perfect divine creator to do. But if Mary was perfectly full of grace so that every decision she makes, she knows is always in accord with God's will, then she's free to say no, that's in accord with his will, or to say yes. And she does so without any fear of punishment because she has been given these graces from the moment that she was conceived to be protected from sin. So that I find is another interesting supplementary argument when reason, tradition, and scripture are all put together, I think make a very good case for the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. So I hope that is helpful.
I hope it was, Andrew, in northern Utah. Thanks very much for the question. This one, another drop call. This one comes from Richie in, what do we think, Cloquette or Cloquet, Mississippi?
Are we playing a nice round of Cloquet?
Don't be coquettish with me. All right.
Yeah, I was about to say coquettish. I'm sorry that I'm so coy about my answer because I am such a young proprietor of this establishment.
I'm a young proprietor. Richie,
maybe it's Cloquet.
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 Cloquet, Mississippi.
Michigan?
Michigan? Oh, yeah, MS is
Cloquet,
Mississippi.
Cloquet Michigan.
This is pathetic. He was listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. How would you respond to a Protestant who asks why they can't receive communion?
Well, I would say to them, what did St. Paul say happened to those who would receive, eat and drink of the body and blood of the Lord, but without discerning the body and blood of the Lord? He said that great harm would come upon them. There were people even dying in Corinth. Because they were eating and drinking of the Eucharist unworthily, not discerning the body. Well, if you are a Protestant, you do not believe in the real presence. At most, maybe you believe in some kind of consubstantiation, where you believe Christ is spiritually present in the bread and the wine. But what we believe is that the Eucharist is a miracle, that if God's miracle ceased, because only the accidents of bread and wine remain, the substance of Christ's body and blood is present, that if the miracle were to cease, like the bread and wine would just simply disappear. there would be nothing there anymore. But the accidents have been preserved for us to receive Christ's perfect sacrifice under the unbloody forms of bread and wine. And of course, Jesus didn't say, this is a symbol of my body. He didn't say, this contains my body. He just said, tauto este, this is my body. So I would say that there's a danger here in that you are receiving Christ and you haven't fully discerned it. even if you have fully discerned, in receiving the Eucharist, this is a sign that you have communion not just with Christ, but with his church, that you say, I'm in communion not just with you, but with the church you've established, and I accept its teachings. But if you're a Protestant, you don't accept all the teachings of the Catholic Church, because if you did accept all the teachings of the Catholic faith, you would act on them and be fully received into the church by being confirmed, for example, and being fully received into the faith. But until then, you do not have full communion with the church. So you cannot receive communion with Christ, because in receiving that, we're saying more than just receiving him in his body and blood. We're affirming our communion with him and with his church as the body. That's why Catholics who are out of communion with the church, who have been placed under excommunication, for example, cannot receive the Eucharist until they are reconciled both to God and to the church.
Thank you very much for that question from Michigan, which we finally established. We will be right back with more Drop Calls Open Forum with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
This hour's going quick with Trent Horn. It's always nice to have Trent on, but hey, don't worry about it, because we got another hour with Trent Horn coming up. We'll continue with Drop Calls Open Forum in hour two. Drop calls, they called, they had a great question, but they couldn't stay on the line. So we saved up the questions and we're giving them to Trent. This one comes from Tony in Houston, Texas, who was listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Tony said this: do the Jews have writings or records about Jesus?
Well, yeah, I assume he's talking about ancient writings or records of Jesus,
right?
Because Jewish people have had various writings. That even today, you have Jews who will write about the person of Jesus. Pope Benedict XVI engaged a famous rabbi, Rabbi Jacob Neusner, on the person of Jesus. Maybe it was Shmuley Botich, wrote something that was somewhat praiseworthy of Jesus. I think it was Shmuley Botich who talked about how if you strip away the Christian accretions, you can get the real Jewish Jesus and understand him for who he is. Modern Judaism has had a more positive turn of understanding who Jesus is. More ancient and medieval forms of Judaism had a less than positive view of Jesus. Some considered him a wayward rabbi. Others considered him a sorcerer who was leading Israel astray, and so was a sinner as a result of that and would be punished. Judaism has evolved, you know, has developed in its understanding of Jesus, just as Christians have developed in their understanding of their relationship with the Jewish people. So I would say that the earliest records we have, like I said, you have the Talmud that was written centuries after the time of Christ. The problem is also there are some negative portrayals in the Talmud, but sometimes the Talmud can be difficult to read because it can be ascribing views to people or hypotheticals and other literary frameworks that can be unfamiliar to really pin down as whether people believed a certain thing or not, or who believed it was this rabbi or that rabbi. Probably the oldest Jewish text that we have about Jesus comes from the Jewish historian Josephus, Flavius Josephus. He was writing at around the end of the first century, at least the War of the Jews, Antiquities was written earlier than that. He was a Jewish historian and chronicler. He fought in the first rebellion against Rome during the first Jewish war that culminated in the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem. And he was eventually at a siege. Everybody was killed. He pledged himself to the emperor and was spared and was kept on as a Roman court historian, though he wrote a lot about Judaism. Even today in Israel, you can't really mention his name. He's really considered, he's like the Benedict Arnold of Jews, essentially. So the Antiquities has two references to Jesus that people have pored over, and there are different positions on the authenticity of these references. The one that is generally not disputed is in Book 20 of the Antiquities. It talks about James, who was put to death. It says James, the brother of Jesus, who is called Christ, was put to death. That this was after the Roman procurator had died. It was Albinus or Festus. I can't remember which. One of them died and the other was on the way. I think Albinus was on the way and Festus had died. And so the Sanhedrin, taking advantage of the power vacuum, stoned James to death. Other early chroniclers say he was thrown from the temple, though ancient stoning often did begin. It's not contradictory. Ancient stoning, you often did throw someone off of a tower or a platform, and then you would hit him with rocks. So he was stoned to death for being a breaker of the law, which we would assume is the Mosaic law because he preached Christ. So we have here James, one of the relatives of the Lord, kin, brother can mean, you know, half sibling, cousin, things like that. So a very faint reference there, but an early historical one, hardly anybody doubts that. You got a few mythicists who deny Jesus existed, but otherwise most people don't doubt Book 20 of the Antiquities. Book 18 is a bit of a dicier element. This is called the Testimonium Flavianum. And here in this section, Josephus is talking about Pontius Pilate. Well, actually, this is the only section where he talks about Pilate. He talks about John the Baptist. And he talked about Pilate in other places. It's Tacitus only mentions Pilate once. He's mentioning here, he goes on a digression and he says in book 18, there was a wise man named Jesus, if one ought to call him a man. And to paraphrase it from my memory, one ought to call him a man. He performed many startling deeds. He was the Christ. He won over Jews and Greeks alike. He died. He was crucified by the leading men among us. Then he rose from the dead, and the tribe named after him have not ceased. Almost everybody agrees, except for some more fundamentalist authors. I read one Catholic guy who says it's all authentic. I find that to be shocking. I've never seen anyone take that view. Nearly everybody agrees there are parts in here that have been interpolated, that Josephus never converted to Christianity. So if he's writing saying that Jesus is the Messiah and he rose from the dead, these are things Christians probably added later. Now, some people, like the mythicists who say Jesus never existed, claim that the whole thing is a fabrication. I don't buy that. Most scholars don't buy that. They would say there are still originals of Josephus here that a Christian would not write, calling Jesus a wise man. The fact that he even says he's a wise man, if one could call him that, makes it sound like an interpolator added that later. He performs startling deeds. It refers to Christians as a tribe. That was not a popular term among Christians, so they wanted to distinguish themselves from Judaism. But what we get from Josephus, if you get the pared-down version of the Testimonium, seems to be that Jesus was understood to be a wonder worker, someone who was wise, somebody who was impressive to Jews and Greeks, so he had a mission to Jews and Gentiles. He was killed by Jewish leaders, but after his death, those who believed in him did not cease, and they continued to grow as a religion. I think that there's a lot more that could be discussed. Roy Schumann has a good book, Salvation is from the Jews, that talks a lot about the relationship between Judaism and Catholicism that I would definitely recommend.
Thanks, Tony. Thank you for the question. It's a Drop Calls open forum. Trent Horn is our guest, and this one comes from Nathan in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, listening on 94.5 FM. Nathan wanted to know, how do I confront the ideas like purgatory from a Reformed background?
Yeah, so different Protestants have different views on purgatory. I find that non-Reformed Protestants are more open to the concept of purgatory, at least in the sense of it being a mode of sanctification. So you have C.S. Lewis talked about belief in purgatory. Jerry Walls is a Protestant. He is not, I don't know if he would call himself Reformed. He's not a Calvinist. He wrote an entire book critiquing Calvinism. But he has defended a sanctification model of purgatory, saying that, you know, we are Christians, we still struggle with sin. And if we are not completely unattached from sin in this life, we'll be purified from those attachments in the next life. That would be the sanctification model of purgatory. And non-Reformed allow for that because non-Calvinists tend to allow more that human beings cooperate with God's will. So salvation is God acting, he begins it, but human beings cooperate in receiving his grace. So they receive it by making an act of faith, for example, and then they continue by not renouncing the faith. There are non-Calvinists who do believe in once saved, always saved, though. So it does get a little how much we are involved. But usually the non-Calvinists will say, at the very least, we could have chosen to reject God or not. Among the Calvinist sphere, it would be more, well, God is the one who actively wills who will choose him and who will reject him. So, which would really seem to make God, even though Calvinists protest against this, it does seem to really make God the author of sin. If he's the 100% author of salvation, he's the 100% author of damnation. There's really no other way to go that if he actively reprobates and actively saves people, and he wills it in that way. So there's a difficulty there if you think, oh, well, human beings don't ever really act. God is the one that he perfects us. I think, though, from a Reformed background, there's a few other ways to look at this. You could still see that you could still say, look, God is the one who completely acts. Even if you're Reformed, you think that God is the one who completely acts in this way. It doesn't mean that he perfects us all in one go. Paul's letters, for the examples, he says that I have not reached perfection, even though I am not perfect yet. That was a reality. He says salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed. I think it's Romans 13:11. So what Paul is speaking is he talks about salvation as a past, present, and future reality. So that future reality of being perfectly glorified, being perfectly free from sin and all attachments to sin, you could believe that to understand, to say, look, that purgatory is not something that we do. If you have a Reformed background also, you often think like, well, I don't want my works to be what contributes, what is what makes me holy. The church, the term that theologians have used is satis patio. This gets in the other aspect of purgatory. I'll into a second, that what the soul undergoes in purgatory that some people take to mean make satisfaction, as in when I'm in purgatory, I have to do certain things, and only when I've done enough of them can I get out and I have made satisfaction for my sins. No, Christ made perfect satisfaction for our sins. He made perfect satisfaction for them so that we do not face eternal punishment, but it doesn't follow that because Christ died on the cross that we do not have temporal punishment for sin. We don't have that. There is an effect that when we sin in this life, our will is disordered and it's not ordered towards the good as it should be. And it's somewhat painful to realign that order. So in purgatory, the soul undergoes this reordering process to be perfectly ordered towards the good and desiring of it and hating and detesting evil. And God, if you have not reached that point in this life. So the temporal punishments to say, look, whatever happens for you, it's not like that I do anything. Satis Patio, the Catholic Encyclopedia 1911, says that it's a loose connection to satisfaction, but it's completely passive. You don't do anything. God is acting on you. In purgatory, whatever perfectly purifies us, it is God who is working through us and doing that to us 100%. We receive it, but God is the one who is solely acting upon us to make us perfect and fit to be able to enter into heaven, being completely detached from sin. So I think that's what I look at. I also look at with temporal punishments. Look, in Hebrews chapter 12, it's really clear. God disciplines the children that he loves, and discipline involves punishment, may be in this life or maybe in the next life.
Trent Horn is our guest. It's a Drop Calls open forum. So no need to call. We've got the calls. We've got them all lined up. Folks called. They had great questions, but they couldn't stay on the line. We gathered them up, and we're sharing them with Trent and getting his answers. Trent Horn, of course, apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor, as I say, of the Council of Trent podcast, which you can get at TrentHornPodcast.com. But don't do it now. Hang on. We're coming right back with more Trent Horn right after this on Catholic Answers Live.